I'd like to call upon Steve Staples.
Thank you very much, Sharon. Thank you, David, for that really inspiring story and for bringing those voices that we almost hear nothing of, even in here in Canada, and the important struggles of workers in Iraq, which we should be all supporting. I want to thank also StopWar.ca for inviting me here back. It feels like another home for me, back home to Vancouver, and also for the incredible work that's been happening here in the last year, really the incredible numbers and activities and the power of the demonstrations that have been happening here in the Lower Mainland are being heard right across the country, and it's just great to be able to follow the progress and the incredible outpouring and organizing that's happening here in the streets. I just want to say it's been an incredible few months in Canadian politics since the ascension of Paul Martin to the throne of the Liberal Party. Martin has been making so many changes in Ottawa these days that the journalists have been complaining that he should slow down because they can't write fast enough. I'm hopeful that the mounting scandals will keep them even busier over the next few months as the election comes. You know, some people said during the leadership debates in the Liberal Party last year that Martin was very vague on his policies, that he was speaking in broad generalities and not really committing to specific proposals. And so, therefore, it was very hard to pin him down and predict exactly what kind of prime minister he was going to be. But others, like Murray Dobbin, were reminding us all that Martin has a track record, a terrible record, in fact, that has showed how far he was willing to go in tearing up the fabric of the country and gutting social programs in order to appease his backers on Bay Street. You know, Murray succeeded in posing the question, is Paul Martin a CEO for Canada? And newspaper columnists even engaged him in a debate for a while over who was further to the right, Paul Martin or Brian Mulroney. Not a comparison that I would want to be made with. But it was no secret at all during the leadership debate that Martin had improving, I put in quotes, Canada-U.S. relations at the top of his agenda. Martin never came out directly and said that Canada should have joined in the invasion of Iraq, but he has taken many steps in order to do what corporate Canada says he needs to do to get on the invitation list of George Bush, to get that invite down to Washington. This all started back in May of last year when, a few days before he was to make an important speech on foreign policy, Paul Martin paid a visit to the U.S. Embassy Sussex Drive in Ottawa and had a private meeting with U.S. Ambassador Paul Cellucci. You'll all remember Paul Cellucci is the guy who said that when he was appointed to his position, his only instruction from his boss in Washington, Colin Powell, was to get Canada to increase its military spending. Now later, when Chrétien announced that Canada would not endorse the U.S. invasion of Iraq, Cellucci went on the offensive under orders from the White House to express the Bush administration's deep disappointment with Canada. And as a result, some people have stopped referring to him as ambassador and are calling him proconsul Cellucci now. Of course, no one knows what was said during that meeting between Paul Martin and Paul Cellucci, but it did kick off an important relationship between Martin's people and the White House. The Canadian press revealed a couple of weeks ago that Martin's closest advisors continued meeting with Bush administration officials from that point on, right through the leadership race and during the period that Martin took over the reins of the Government of Canada. A few days after that meeting with U.S. Ambassador, though, the normally evasive Paul Martin came out and said that he supported missile defense. It was the first solid thing that he had actually said that he supported, or any policy plank, the first thing that came out of his mouth was that he supported Canada's involvement in missile defense. In speeches shortly thereafter, he talked about pushing billions of dollars more into military spending, being more prepared to move away from the United Nations, and creating new government bodies responsible for national security and cooperation with the United States. And once in power, Paul Martin did not fail to deliver. He created a new committee on Canada-U.S. relations and reorganized government to create a new Department of Public Security that mirrors the United States Department of Homeland Security. He froze all government spending, capital spending, in every department except for helicopters and new tanks for the military. And incidentally, he's even cut, I was down in Halifax recently and people were telling me, he's even cut funding, a measly $5 million out of a $13 billion military budget to Canada's peacekeeping training center that they've established in one of the former bases in Nova Scotia. And everyone is taking this as a signal that peacekeeping will no longer be a priority for our military. The New York Times ran a story on the first weeks of Paul Martin's government, and they pointed how he was moving Canada to the right. And the first evidence of the shift that the article pointed to was Paul Martin's choice for Minister of Defense, this guy named David Pratt. David Pratt's not likely very well known outside of Ottawa. But you may recall that when Jean Chrétien announced that Canada would not endorse the Iraq invasion, every member of the Liberal caucus gave him a standing ovation, except for two members, and one of them was David Pratt. Pratt's an Ottawa area MP who has spent the last few years as the chair of the Parliamentary Defense Committee, or this is officially called the Standing Committee on National Defense and Veterans Affairs. It's an all-party committee, but Pratt quickly gained a reputation as being one of the most hawkish members of the Liberal Party through his leadership on that committee. I went before the committee last year, and I was very surprised when I was making my way through West Block to try to find the room where the committee meets. Outside, there was a handmade sign hanging on the door of the meeting chambers that said, "Welcome to the War Room." This was Pratt's committee meeting space. In 2002, his committee released a report recommending that Canada's military spending be more than doubled. And Canada already spends more than $13 billion on its military, and according to the Department of National Defense itself, dollar for dollar, we're the sixth highest military spender within NATO's 19 members and the 15th highest military spender in the world. But David Pratt's committee called for a volley of $2 billion a year in increases to military spending for every year for 3 years, and then an increase to the NATO average of 2.5% of GDP, that would set Canada's military spending at a whopping $28 billion a year. Now, David Pratt's riding on the outskirts of Ottawa is also the headquarters of one of the largest weapons corporations in Canada, General Dynamics. And General Dynamics is one of the top 10 military contractors in the world based in the United States. And here in Canada, they build tanks in London, Ontario, and military electronics in Ottawa, and other locations across Canada. Now, I attended an arms show last year in Ottawa where dozens of companies were demonstrating their latest equipment and weapons. I tend to go undercover for some of these events for revealing research purposes, and this one didn't fail to deliver. At the luncheon for the arms show, I wasn't too surprised to see seated at the General Dynamics corporate table several business types there in their suits, some military brass, and of course there was David Pratt chowing down on some fine chicken Kiev with a good host from General Dynamics. Now, when Pratt was appointed defense minister, you know, really the defense lobby could barely contain its glee. The Conference of Defense Associations immediately sent out a press release congratulating Martin for making such a fine choice as for defense minister. And other military think tanks extolled Pratt as a man who understands the needs of the military. As defense minister, Pratt is taking the lead on joining Canada to the United States National Missile Defense System. In early January, he sent a letter to his U.S. counterpart, Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld, seeking more information on the U.S. system in order to aid Canada in making a decision on, as Pratt said, the closest possible cooperation on the U.S. missile shield system. Now, David Pratt's letter, when you actually looked at it, came as a shock, a bit of a shock to those in the diplomatic community, some of the folks that occasionally get to talk to. Some of them were saying it was too eager, almost sycophantic in its support for the U.S. system, and possibly damaged whatever negotiating ability Canada has because it gave up so much in the letter. But the letter was timed to achieve an important impact in Washington only days before Paul Martin's much-anticipated meeting with George W. Bush. Canada's participation in missile defense is widely seen as the price of atonement for our not joining the war in Iraq. The two men met in Monterrey, Mexico, Bush and Martin, during the Summit of the Americas, along with Bill Graham, our foreign minister, and on the U.S. side, there was Ambassador Salucci, Condoleezza Rice, and Colin Powell. I and a couple of other people that were there had media accreditation, and we were able to sit in on Paul Martin's first press conference after his breakfast meeting with Bush. And the guy was just beaming. I mean, he was just so pleased with himself, with his meeting. And he said that there was a good vibe. There was a good vibe between him and the president, right? I mean, it looked like Martin will win the big prize, which is a visit to the White House sometime before the Canadian election. What was left out of the press conference, though, was any mention of the fact that Paul Martin pledged to the U.S. president to change Canada's foreign policy to make it more complementary to that of the United States. It took about 2 weeks for that little important piece of information to come out in the Canadian press. Now, for many Canadians, there's been a let's wait and see attitude toward Paul Martin. You know, is he as bad as some people say? Is Murray Dobbin right? Or have we not really seen all there is to Paul Martin? But in trying to figure out the man, however, I've been told it's best not to listen to what he says, but watch what he does. And what he's done in just the last short weeks is very worrying. Even if one would want to argue whether or not these are truly Paul Martin's personal feelings, such as support for missile defense, there is no mistake that there is a strident campaign in Canada right now for this country to shake off its old soft power and human security foreign policy and get on board with the United States. There are powerful forces at play in the U.S. and here in Canada that want to convince the government that we should quit being an advocate for human security, forget peace and disarmament, move away from peacekeeping, let's make our forces combat capable, and instead that these old policies should be replaced with an acceptance and really an enthusiasm for George Bush's war on terrorism, they argue. But let's just take a moment, take a look back and see how we arrived at this important point. You know, it took only 12 hours after the September 11th terrorist attacks for President Bush to gather his war council. It was quoted that he said to them, "This is our time. Get the troops ready." Days later, as the war plans were being laid for the attack on Afghanistan, Bush used his speech to the special joint session of Congress to issue his challenge to governments around the world. And he said, "Every nation in every region has a decision to make. Either you're with us or you're with the terrorists." So this stark choice put old enemies and allies alike, including Canada, made it clear that the United States expected not just support for, but active participation in the looming war on terrorism. I mean, at the time of the September 11th attacks, the Canadian Department of National Defense's policy group, which is responsible for producing an overview survey of the global strategic environment, were just going to press with their 2001 strategic assessment. And because of the obvious change, the shift in the September 11th attacks, they quickly wrote a two-page assessment of the global changes that those attacks would precipitate and stapled it to the end of their report in the epilogue. Their assessment at that time was chilling and predicted the dramatic global buildup and warfare that came after that report. The DND analysts concluded that transnational terrorism would be regarded as the primary threat to international security, and that, quote, "the balance of the notion of human security and traditional concepts of security will likely shift in the direction of defending national territory and populations away from championing poverty eradication and human rights. The results would be that previous concerns to avoid combat casualties and military operations and to minimize collateral damage will be of less importance than achieving military objectives." This is coming from DND. For the United States, DND predicted the establishment of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Northern Command, and a missile defense system. And even more, DND saw that international law will be cast aside in the search for terrorists. They said the standards for proof of complicity and responsibility for terrorist attacks before undertaking counter-terrorist actions will likely be relaxed in favor of results. The international system will be reordered into allies or enemies in the fight against terror, they put in their assessment. Countries that try to adopt a neutral stance will find themselves under pressure to take sides. Traditional U.S. allies will find that calls for military, diplomatic, and other support from Washington will be regarded as a test of their loyalty. The National Defense Department's Strategic Assessment 2001 reads like a terminal prognosis for Canada's recent foreign policy achievements. I mean, during the 1990s, Canada tried to help shape the post-Cold War security environment by promoting various international initiatives that sought to strengthen international law. For example, we supported the creation of the International Criminal Court. That was an attempt to put the conduct of war inside the constraints of international law. Other disarmament initiatives, including reviewing NATO's reliance on nuclear weapons and the landmines treaties, were used as opportunities to reverse the proliferation of indiscriminate weaponry from atom bombs to landmines. And the government's international initiatives led by Foreign Affairs Minister Lloyd Axworthy attempted to redefine military intervention priorities and doctrines by promoting peacekeeping and using and promoting human rights, this notion of human rights, promoting this notion of human security. The common feature of all of these initiatives that we were putting forward at that time is that they were all rejected by the United States. The Clinton administration supported neither the International Criminal Court nor the Landmines Treaty, and U.S. control within NATO quashed any notion of it giving up reliance on the nuclear umbrella. Peacekeeping and human security remain alien concepts to the Pentagon's warfighting initiatives. So George W. Bush's landmark 2002 national security strategy of the United States of America, better known as the Bush Doctrine, focused on unilateralism and unrestrained use of military power. This new grand strategy, as Bush put forward, was very significant because for the first time it really fused together military and economic objectives in order to achieve national interests. Now, Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Defense Director Paul Wolfowitz, two of the main architects of the Bush Doctrine, moved quickly in pushing through reforms in the military following September 11th. In October of 2001, they created the Office for Force Transformation within the Pentagon and appointed Vice Admiral Arthur Sabrowski as its director. Sabrowski has been tasked with transforming the United States military to fight the war on terrorism. Now, it was an important speech that he gave to that right-wing think tank, the Heritage Foundation, in May of last year. And you can check it out on the Heritage Foundation's website if you're interested in seeing it. It was here that Sabrowski laid out how the terrorist attacks against the United States affected U.S. and global politics so profoundly that they had ushered in a new era of globalization. Sabrowski said, "Now we see the emergence of a new globalization, a new set of rules. The new phase was facilitated by the movement from the industrial age to the information age," according to Sabrowski, and the end of the Cold War in 1989 removed the static, bipolar global environment. And today, according to him, the world map has been redrawn, divided by those regions in the world whose markets are connected through globalization and those areas of the world that resist being connected into globalization. Sabrowski said, "We used to talk, for example, about the haves and the have-nots. Now we talk about the functioning core of globalization versus the non-functioning gap of globalization. And now we can see threats then in a completely different light, i.e. the threats are coming from those countries that are not connected into globalization. Now America's privileged position within globalization and the system itself must be defended." He said, we indeed do have a privileged position, noting that America accounts for only 5% of the world's population, but produces and mostly consumes upwards of 25% of the world's wealth. So the Bush administration's Office of Force Transformation is preparing the U.S. military to enforce the Bush Doctrine. Sabrowski said, "If you're fighting globalization, if you reject the rules, if you reject the connectivity, you are probably going to be of interest to the United States Department of Defense." The day following the announcement of the Bush Doctrine that so clearly fused together national security and free trade, U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick, the guy that's responsible for negotiating free trade deals and going to the World Trade Organization and the FTAA, he announced that there was going to be a new imperative for his office. He said trade agreements would be used as leverage to achieve reforms in countries that want deals with the United States. Now, critics of this change in strategy, such as former World Bank chief economist Joseph Stiglitz, said that Zoellick's initiative would be viewed as an example of the U.S. trying to strong-arm the world. The new strategy puts the United States as a central arbiter of the global economy, pushing out the World Trade Organization, the IMF, and the other multilateral bodies. The patience and restraint required in multilateral venues such as the World Trade Organization cannot deliver on the economic rewards and punishments that the United States wants to be able to dole out. As Walden Bellow argues, the globalization game plan has shifted in a significant way. For the Bush people, Walden says, strategic power is the ultimate modality of power. Economic power is a means to achieve a strategic power. And this is related to the fact that under Bush, the dominant faction of the ruling elite is the military-industrial establishment that won the Cold War. So globalization will continue, but only in a fashion that combines U.S. security and economic benefit. Walden says the Bush administration has supplanted the globalist political economy of the Clinton period with the unilateralist nationalist political economy that intends to shore up the global dominance of the U.S. corporate elite. So there's a shift from an elite that benefited from the globalization and global trade towards a nationalist elite that benefits from state intervention and being protected within nation states. So it's still elites, but it's just a different allegiance. So the global capitalist elites, as Bellow describes those interests that benefited from the global capitalist economy, are being disciplined to accept the Bush doctrine. I mean, the U.S. Council for International Business now admits that in the WTO, it's always understood that security trumps trade. So economic ties have been used to punish reluctant allies as well. Multi-billion dollar loan from the IMF to Turkey was taken off the table when it refused to join the invasion of Iraq. A long-time dispute between the United States and New Zealand over that country's refusal to allow U.S. nuclear-powered or armed ships visits to New Zealand has unofficially delayed a long-sought free trade deal between the two countries. And the prospect of another closure of the Canada-U.S. border that occurred on September 11th has sent Canada's corporate elite scrambling as well. Their fear is that if Canada's refusal to endorse the invasion of Iraq is bringing economic retaliation to the country in the form of trade disruptions like the softwood lumber deal. Having worked so hard to achieve the first free trade agreement and later NAFTA, the Canadian corporations think that Canada has to sign on to the U.S.'s war effort in order to protect our access to the U.S. market. So the United States has been using this fear to rally corporate pressure on the government. Security will trump trade, said Ambassador Salucci, raising the specter of increased problems at the border. And it was a carefully crafted message designed to agitate resistance to the Chrétien government and energize pro-U.S. elements of the Canadian society, the business class, Canadian Alliance, and the Tory parties, conservative elements of the Liberal Party, and especially the military. On the first anniversary of the terrorist attacks against the United States, Canada's former ambassador to the U.S., Alan Gottlieb, used the pages of the National Post to call for a grand bargain with the United States. He said the Canadian political agenda is economic security. For Americans, it's homeland security. Therein lies the political elements of a grand negotiation. A succession of reports, op-eds, speeches, and conferences that have emanated from conservative think tanks and foundations in Canada have been arguing for a comprehensive agreement with the United States in order to ensure Canada's economic security, as Gottlieb described it. All of these proposals, interestingly, contain an admission, whether explicit or implicit, that the gains made towards greater economic integration with the United States, achieved through the first free trade agreement and later NAFTA, risk being undermined by the U.S. security measures being put in place at the border. Wendy Dobson of the C.D. Howe Institute wrote that NAFTA has largely outlived its usefulness. Canadian concerns about economic security must be linked with U.S. domestic priorities to attract the U.S.'s notice. And homeland security is the single overriding U.S. goal. And what's needed, this is Dobson, what's needed is a strategic framework that links security and defense with economic goals. You see the mirroring of the Bush Doctrine, the bringing together of the security and the economic interests together, really for the first time, I think, that we've seen in quite a while anyway. So this is the basis of unity, the linking of economic and military interests together. It's the basis of unity between two powerful lobbies in Canada, the corporate lobby and the defense lobby. They're working together now, each coming together through its desire to increase the militarization of Canada through increased military spending and greater integration with the United States. So if Canada continues to pursue an independent foreign policy, both lobbies see their aims being marginalized. Join on with the Bush Doctrine and the War on Terrorism, and the corporation and the generals are all winners. The most prominent organization for military to push for military and economic integration is the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. Well, who are these guys? Some of you maybe they're rebranded the BCNI, right? The Business Council on National Issues. Still head by longtime free trade advocate Thomas DeQuino. And DeQuino has been working in government and corporate circles for more than 30 years, and he describes himself as one of the foremost Canadian policy strategists. He writes this in his own bio. So, and he says, and he admits, one of the private sector architects of the Canada-United States Free Trade Initiative and a leading exponent of NAFTA. Now, DeQuino's critics may have other ways to describe his accomplishment, but really no one disputes the fact that Tom DeQuino has played a key role in the rise of neoconservatism in Canada. And today, his group still represents Canada's most wealthy and powerful people from the corporate community, but its main focus has been on achieving the grand bargain between Canada and the United States. He told the National Post earlier this year, he says, we feel that free trade one, this is what he calls it, free trade one was sort of a transforming chapter in the relationship between Canada and the United States. And he went on to say, you know, I would say that this is a second chapter of that transformative initiative, the second chapter being the military and combined economic integration with the United States. So DeQuino has organized an action group, as he calls it, of 30 CEOs to promote his plan for what he calls North American security and prosperity. Now, the list of these 30 CEOs comprises powerhouses from the banking, the oil and gas, and defense industries, including former Canadian ambassador to the United States, Derek Burney, who's currently president of CAE. The CAE generates more than $500 million from military contracts annually, much of it from the Pentagon. In April, DeQuino organized a private meeting of between dozens of Canadian CEOs and Bush administration officials in Washington. And according to one report that was in the Financial Post, some executives emerged from the room visibly shaken from the stern rebuke they were given by Richard Perle, the influential defense advisor, often less affectionately known as the Prince of Darkness. The reporter said one CEO came from the room visibly shaking, saying Perle had warned them, shaking a finger. They said, in future, Canada better realize where its best interests lie. Well, the corporations got the message. DeQuino used the meeting to raise $2 million for his North American Security and Prosperity Initiative. I went inside a conference recently in Ottawa, where DeQuino was one of the main speakers. Tickets were $850 for a two-day event, and it was all based around promoting economic and military integration with the United States. A few groups cobbled some money together so that we could go inside and gather some intelligence. And in a room full of high-level bureaucrats, DeQuino recounted how he had spent a week last summer with George Bush Sr. fishing in Labrador. And he used the opportunity to pitch to the father president his North American and security plan. And he said that Bush was really skeptical at first. You know, why would Americans be interested in this security and prosperity initiative? And DeQuino said, you know, look, George, we could work together to make North America an island of prosperity and security. And DeQuino said that Bush looked at him and said, now that's something that Americans would be interested in. So the stakes in this game are really nothing less than the future independence of Canada, our ability to set our own course on how we want to organize ourselves, organize our economy, and how we want to engage in the world. It's clear that powerful forces have been arrayed for the next phase of integration, this next phase of globalization. Now, the question is, will Canada be transformed to mirror the United States, accepting the Bush Doctrine of war and war profits as our worldview? And what's Paul Martin's answer to that question? You know, the Globe and Mail laid it out very plainly for Martin in its first editorial of the year. On January 1st, the Globe's editorialist wrote that Paul Martin, the finance minister, successfully alerted Canadians to the dangers of the deficit and taught people to accept cuts to social programs in order to fight the deficit. They said his next job is to get Canadians to accept holding the line on social programs so that the money can be used to build up the military. This coming election, expected in a few months, is going to be an important opportunity for us to put these issues before Canadians. Martin is clearly worried about Jack Layton and has been spending a lot of time attacking the NDP while also putting off some issues until after the election to try to avoid dealing with them now, not the least of which is missile defense, where a decision will not be made until the fall. The question of Canada's participation in missile defense could be a symbol of Martin's rush to embrace George Bush and to appease those hawkish Republican extremists occupying the White House right now. Missile defense, I think, represents Canada giving up its traditional contributions to the world and trading it in for Star Wars, a system that even Brian Mulroney didn't believe in. But we can't forget that the election night will not be an end of the campaign, but really it's going to be a beginning of the campaign. The corporations have put this together in terms of a 5-year plan, and I think that we should be thinking in these terms too. People who were around during the 1980s that I talked to say, you know, this time period right now feels like the very early days of the free trade debate back then, you know, 1984, 1985, and I'm sure there's folks here that may be getting that same kind of feeling. And it was at that time that civil society came together to name what was happening and to show the terrible impacts that free trade would have on Canadians. And I really think that the challenge right now is no different than what it was then. We need to remind Canadians of their own values of community, of sharing and openness, and we need to engage the world and not hide behind this American missile shield. Chrétien, you know, had a warning for Paul Martin at the Liberal Leadership Convention. You might remember what he said. He probably looked at Martin in the crowd and said, "Beware of those who put the bottom line ahead of all else." And he said he repeated it about 3 times in the speech. I wonder if Martin was listening. I also hope that Martin heard what George Bush said the morning of their breakfast in Monterey. Bush said, "I can assure Canadians we'll do everything we can to protect the United States." It's bizarre language. So the corporations want Canadians to give up and accept Star Wars, accept more soldiers and more guns, in order to keep the trade moving over the border and to keep the money changing hands. You know, I call this profits over principles. You know, but Canadians have been telling pollsters over and over again that they don't want to follow the United States' path. In December, 3 out of 4 Canadians who were polled by Maclean's said that they agreed that it was right for Canada to stay out of the invasion of Iraq, even if it annoyed our closest trading partner, the United States, and possibly even cost Canadians jobs. I call this principles over profits. So I really feel it's up to us. You know, the campaign for a new independent and democratic Canada, I feel, really needs to start right now. And let it start right here in this room tonight. And we'll take it into the streets on March 20th. And we'll take it into the election and really keep going until we win. Thank you very much.